Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we have five fun facts in FinTech. FinTech jumps into construction, and shadow banking strikes again. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get going. With me this week is Monica.
Hey, John.
Looking lovely as ever.
Oh,
and
thanks.
Steve.
Looking not so lovely. Hello.
All right. Look great, Steve. Stop.
Thanks.
Those gray hairs suit you.
Oh, thank you.
We had a room full of them.
Well, I'd like to think that we always have fun facts here on the FinTech Newscast, but you have a special targeted list from our friends at the IMF.
At the International Monetary Fund.
The Fun Fund.
Yeah, so the IMF recently published this amazing blog post that had five facts about fintech. Sort of, it's a look back at what the fintech industry has done globally. They convened a panel of experts from the IMF and the World Bank. They interviewed a bunch of central bankers and came up with five key trends or facts that we've seen in fintech over the past, again, 5 years or so.
Yeah, and you know, Christine Lagarde, she was head of the IMF, and now she'll be head of the ECB, the European mm-hmm. Central Bank, right?
Correct, yeah, yeah.
Maybe this was her last project, is to put together these five fun facts for us.
Five fun facts, yeah, and here we are, yeah. My favorite Christine Lagarde tidbit is that she used to be a competitive synchronized swimmer,
yes.
Oh,
and she competed,
gosh,
I think, in the Olympics for France.
So. Oh, was it the Olympics?
I think it was the Olympics, yeah.
So, I feel actually like synchronized swimming is probably really good experience for participating
she jokes
as
about
a bureaucrat.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in lockstep. You have to know your stuff. You have to be.
Yeah. Everybody's got to be on the same page.
Yeah.
Maybe we need more leaders.
Who do synchronized swimming?
Maybe that's the next hot trend in leadership offsites.
Working rigorous physical exercise. Yeah.
Working well
synchronized
with
swimming.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. But they publish five facts. None are really, you know, stuff that will blow your mind if you follow the fintech space, but they should look kind of interesting. So let's go from the bottom. Let's do the countdown.
Okay.
Number five.
Fun fact.
And actually, this is, I think, my favorite, is that they say that digital currencies backed by central banks could become a reality.
I like this could like a, it's like a, for the past 5 years. Right?
Well, it's still, you know, so we're recording this today and we saw that Jerome Powell was on, you know, testified today regarding Libra and Calibra and all that stuff. So we're still kind of, I think in the nascent stages. So I can see where they're hedging by saying could for this one.
But you could also see how they could easily say, all right, well, we've already got a currency. We could just make a stablecoin that matches it. And central banks are actually in a really good position to kind of hold it stable, relatively stable, within the confines of that currency's fluctuations.
Right. And they cite four reasons why this could be the case. They are a digital currency could lower cost. It could increase efficiency of monetary policy implementation. It could actually counter competition from crypto,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. So again, kind of rein the power back into the central banks
and make sure we get our taxes on those transactions.
Yeah,
right.
Boy, I'm a little bit slow on the uptake on that.
Yeah.
Okay, no, I'm against all of this.
You're against all this stuff. Yeah. And the other one is that they would ensure contestability of the payment market. Meaning that, you know, once you make a transaction, you can actually maybe call that back. It's not as it's not like in Venmo or Zelle, where if you pay somebody, it's hard to get that money
or
back.
Or Bitcoin,
for the matter. Yeah, yeah. So kind of interesting.
There's no undo button.
No undo button. Yeah. So I think that if we have a digital currency backed by central banks, we'd have more of a.
And then Jerome Powell, his concern with Libra and, you know, all of the cryptocurrencies really is the potential for fraud. Money laundering.
Terrorist financing.
Yeah.
Right.
And all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, that's true across the board. So.
But anyway, that's number four.
Although, that's also true with cash.
Correct. Yeah, it's true. But, you know, cash is bulky and all that, and it's difficult to, yeah, anyway. Yeah, it's an issue. Number four. Europe is not unified when it comes to fintech adoption. I think we've seen that, actually. If you travel across Western Europe, you know, they all have kind of their own systems. Everyone has their internal ways to do business. There's a lot of great fintech, in, for example, in Sweden and in Germany and the UK as well. France, not so much.
But why is this an argument for central bank cryptocurrency?
No.
This is the fourth fun fact.
Oh, it's a fun fact.
Yes.
Okay.
This is the fourth.
I'm slow on the update.
This is the fourth fun fact from the International Monetary Fund.
So things aren't even across Europe.
They're not even across Europe, and it's just different economies in different countries have different levels of, say, wallet adoption. So that in Sweden, for example, they actually have a policy where you can't. The percentage of the population that actually can use a digital wallet has to be restricted because they don't want to exclude seniors or whatever. So, and that's very different from for example, Spain or Portugal, where you have a much lower uptake of these services.
You know, it just made me think. I was actually in Italy a few weeks ago, and, you know, you just look
as
up.
As you are.
Yeah, as one
as
does.
Do.
Take a summer vacay. And, you know, many Italian cities and Italy at large has a relatively older population base. And I wonder if kind of the average or median age has something to do with how some of these alternative modes of payment and just transacting your financial life, how that affects it. You know, if you've got a median age of 50 in a nation, you probably have a different appetite for local fintech services than 32.
Right, right. Very, very good point.
Yeah. Again, it reminds me, too, of those Amazon Go stores where you have to have the app to get into the to the store and shop. But then some cities like San Francisco are requiring, or I think they're considering requiring that those stores be able to take cash for people that, you know, might not have a smartphone or.
I think the Amazon Go store here on Pine Street, is it on Pine or Market? I think it's on Pine. The one on Market on Pine Street now in SF, in downtown SF, they now have to accept EBT, so food stamps, and cash as well.
Okay, so that's already enforced.
It's already enforced, yeah, absolutely. And great, so our third fact, drum roll please. Sub-Saharan Africa is a global leader in mobile money innovation, adoption, and usage. This makes sense if you've used a service like M-Pesa, right, in Kenya?
Yes.
Of course, famously.
As you do,
as one does. Yeah.
Yes.
Famously, Sub-Saharan Africa kind of bypassed the whole landline stage and went straight to mobile. So as a result, they're really forward-thinking and a lot of usage around mobile payments and wallets and SMS banking and all that kind of stuff.
I was in Kenya in 2011, and M-Pesa was everywhere and used by everyone. And if you think about where we were in digital payments in the U.S. in 2011, or probably any other place, even 2019, we're still not there.
Not at all. Yeah, absolutely.
But that's because most people have credit cards and debit cards, and we have the infrastructure to support that. And everywhere we go has electricity, so you can run all those cards.
Right.
Not the case in Kenya.
Right, right. Number two, and I think we've actually talked about this several times on the pod, but Asia is ahead of other regions in many aspects of fintech, particularly China. Mm-hmm. I had a colleague who went to China maybe a month and a half ago or so, and she mentioned that there was no way that she could pay for stuff with cash anymore. It was all QR codes and all the apps. And at first, she was reluctant to actually use all the apps because she was concerned with privacy issues. And having these companies that are very closely linked to the government know where she's spending money. But eventually, she was like, screw this. I'm just going to give in. I'm going to buy everything with my card now.
I love Big Brother.
I love Big Brother. Yeah. Hello, Big Brother. But
I feel like I need to bring a burner phone when I go to China and leave my real one at home.
I think some companies actually bar you from bringing your laptop to China.
They definitely do.
Yeah.
They definitely do. I know I actually have a friend who works for a big tech company here, and he can't even bring his cell phone when he visits China.
Yeah. It makes sense. So.
Yeah. There was an article where I don't know if they sneak the app onto your phone or they require you to, as part of like the entry, to enter your information in a certain app, and then that monitors your phone. But there's cases in China of people coming back and they had this malicious software from the Chinese government on their phone.
Same if you log on to your hotel Wi-Fi. Never do that in China because you'll be tracked.
And don't search for Tiananmen Square Massacre.
Right. Don't do any of that.
Unless you need the police to come help you right away.
Right. Don't do that.
And don't try to Google search. And don't try to go to YouTube. And don't try to go to the New
Baidu
York Times.
Baidu search, I mean.
Let me Baidu that.
We pay that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, number one, the number one fun fact, according to the IMF.
What is it, Steve?
It's so exciting. This is actually a really, really good one. Cybersecurity and data protection risk recognize no boundaries with spillover across sectors and countries, and governments are working hard to get a handle on the issue. In plain English, there's a lot of threats out there, and everyone, and no government has a really good handle on that yet.
I agree with the first part. I'm not really sure exactly what governments are really going to be able to do in some of these circumstances, right? Everything digital is hackable, which means that finding the perpetrators becomes that much more difficult. It's going to be messy.
To be quite messy, yeah.
Even when it's great, it's going to be messy.
Right. Well, luckily our friends at the IMF are keeping an eye on this.
I'm sorry, IMF. That is not disrespectful. It just sounded that
unless
way.
Unless it's the impossible mission for
unless
us.
It's exactly. Unless it's the IMF from the Tom Cruise movies.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Interesting and good reminders. I mean, we forget about some of the basics sometimes, especially data security and changing your password and trends in Africa. So yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, IMF.
Thanks, IMF. Keeping an eye out. All right, let's go to an area that we don't talk about enough, actually, but it's been getting a lot of money and a lot of attention, is fintech getting into commercial real estate and construction. So they're actually calling this prop tech.
Which, of course they
are. What's the prop for?
Property.
Property.
Property technology. Yeah.
I thought it was like, yo, you get props.
Props.
No. Also, props.
Well, if you have a startup doing this, going into this area, you're getting a lot of financial props because the funding for real estate tech startups has gone up huge. In 2013, the funding was only at $491 million, which, okay,
respectable.
Fine. I'll take $1 million of that, along with 491 other people. But last year, it was at $12.7 billion. And in 2019, just through the first half, it's already passed that number at $12.9 billion.
Wait, just in the last 6 months?
Just in the first half of 2019, yes.
Wow. Yeah.
It's that already passed incredible. All of 2017's number.
So can you give me an example of a company that actually works in PropTech? Like, what is PropTech?
Oh, so there's a lot of different things, a lot of ways that commercial real estate and construction can benefit from better technology. Actually, a lot of it, well, some of it at least, is driven by WeWork. So they've kind of risen the bar a bit for everybody else. So things like having a key card to get in everywhere, or you log in and then the seat adjusts to your specifications, the way you have, so anywhere you go in the company, that's still set.
Or even not having a key card, you being able to use your smartphone instead of a key card.
Yes. Ooh. Whoa, yes.
That's worth $1 billion right
or
there.
Or just scanning with your eyeball.
Yeah. And, iris
to get snacks out of the machine.
I think we were on break when this happened, but there's an amazing story in New York Magazine about Adam Newman.
Randy Newman. I love his music.
Not Randy Newman.
He's
yeah,
great.
I love his stuff. Yeah, short people, great stuff. Great stuff. no, there's a really amazing article about the WeWork thing and how they're, you know, a lot of sexual harassment and why they're so overvalued and actually comparing the company to other similar entities that have existed for much longer and how they have maybe a tenth of the value that WeWork has. So kind of an interesting view into prop tech over here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, big companies are seeing this kind of competitive threat. Brookfield Asset Management has $191 billion of real estate assets under management. And they've been one of the big investors into these prop tech startups. And, you know, it's starting to show now that there's all this money coming in, there's some prop tech unicorns. These are companies that are valued at more than $1 billion. There's more than 20 of them since 2014.
Wow.
In this one space,
yeah.
So what are the other 19 other than WeWork?
Okay, no. this is not a listicle.
Airbnb is one,
right? Oh,
right. They're
yeah.
in real estate.
Interesting.
Yeah. So these kinds of competitors and new ideas are driving the industry.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting in this article is they talk about how, you know, the ideas that are coming up in prop tech have been around for a long time, but it just didn't really make financial sense for property owners or commercial real estate companies to really go for it. Whereas now, as property values are plateauing, they need to eke more or the same amount of profit out of a building. And so now they're looking at ways to maximize revenue or relatively inexpensively create more amenities that will allow them to retain their current tenants or raise rents.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And yeah, there's more things become possible. There's more services that you can offer. So one fun idea that they talk about in this article, this is in the Wall Street Journal, is using drones to do regular surveillance on a construction site. So they can monitor, like the architect firm can monitor that the construction is being done according to all the plans.
It can supplement on-site security staff.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, at nighttime, they can keep the place safe from people pulling copper, right, out of the construction sites.
Is that a thing for people pulling copper?
Yeah. I don't know. What's the global price of copper? Yeah.
And so you have these property companies that have, and you don't think of them this way, but they have a head of innovation that's testing out and implementing these new products. Along with the commercial real estate is construction as well. And again, WeWork has been working on robots that help with their construction on their sites, so they can automate that and standardize their office buildings as much as they can. I talked to an architect at WeWork a little while ago, and they were testing these painting robots that can just repaint the walls. So if the tenant wants prefers a different color or their company colors, for example, they can just have their robots paint all the places and eliminate that many more jobs.
And Andrew Yang just shuddered.
Yes.
Which one's Andrew Yang?
He's the one who's running on a universal basic income because automation and robotics are going to put so many billions of people
in the world. It's $1,000 for every American every month, right?
That's his proposal. Yeah. But I do think he's right that we're on the cusp of seeing a massive shift in do machines or people do the work.
Yep.
Yeah. And you don't think of construction as being kind of tech heavy, but it's getting affected.
Or painting, for Christ's sakes. But yeah.
I have my painting robot take care of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I guess kind of like a Roomba, right? It measures out the space, or you put the specs in and go. There's other things like having modular pieces for construction. So there's a company called Top Hat that builds modular homes, so they can standardize the construction on like assembly line kind of setup, so that it makes the cost a lot cheaper.
I'm a devoted This Old House watcher, and modular homes are amazing because they can have different people working on multiple systems at the same time. They never have to worry about getting rained out. They don't have to wait for things to dry after bad weather. It's very, very impressive. The issue with a lot of modular homes is really around like codes. Will your municipality let you erect something that may not look like what they're used to? So,
well, they're not uniform too. So you get it in one, you know, county, but not in the next one.
Exactly. So there's a lot of variability in that. But I think I definitely think modular building is the way to do it. And
really?
In fact, when you look at the way most commercial buildings are put together, they are pretty much done in a standardized format and things go up really fast. And residential homes simply don't.
I think that's the reason why a lot of the new buildings now, they're, you know, sort of there's like a new condo look. It's all glass and steel. It's because that's the cheapest way to do it. And they have a streamlined way of building all this stuff out. So it's not as
yes,
unique.
And actually Bloomberg did a real estate issue a few months ago, Bloomberg Business Week. And it is fascinating if you're a real estate hound. So some of that has to do with how do you maximize the amount of living space and habitable units in a given footprint? And it ends up looking very much the same everywhere you go. Those buildings are usually wood framed, and you can only typically go so high in building codes with a wood frame, but it goes up so much more cheaply than steel, which is really expensive and quite a bit more complicated to erect. So
not if you have a robot on it.
Probably not.
Maybe
someday. So slightly different tangent. But yeah. Again, if you are interested in what is going on in real estate and why things are the way they are, cannot recommend that back issue of Business Week enough.
We will link to that one.
So they have
we're going to let him keep it.
We'll have the link for this article. And there's some great examples. There's a company, Katera, that does standardized wall panels. And they say they can put up an apartment building in 90 days.
Yes, please.
Pretty code, impressive, yeah. Apparently.
Come to SF, please.
Yeah. Or, if the city would allow them in the door. iMod Structures builds modular classrooms that can be moved around with the kids in the building when they move it.
Yeah. I think that's an editorializing
maybe
comment, please.
Maybe not. But yeah, some interesting things out there in construction and real estate.
Absolutely.
So get your startup going.
Nice.
There's money for you.
Welcome to the PropTech Newscast.
Yeah. Now let's go to somewhere that we haven't talked about too much in terms of fintech and shadow banking, but it's starting to have a big effect, is in India, the home of a lot of technology and a lot of growth in non-bank lenders, which is what shadow banking, well, non-bank financial activity, which is what shadow banking is. So they're having some problems, just like everywhere, in managing, regulating, and dealing with the volatility that not being able to manage your shadow banking industry is causing. And this is happening as some companies are running into trouble and going out of business or missing their payments. Something similar, it doesn't seem like as large a scale as that similar breakdown in China, and certainly not the crackdown. But the Reserve Bank of India, the governor, said that they were starting to look at this sector more. And he says that the RBI will not hesitate to take whatever steps are necessary to ensure that financial stability is not adversely impacted.
Big but, talk.
Yeah.
Easy to say, hard to do.
It's starting to happen already. They're looking at more regulation. Yeah, the cat might be out of the bag a little bit. Growth in the non-bank sector has already taken off. It's up 16.2% just from 2018 to 2019 in the past year. And the financial sector credit growth is up 10%, according to Societe Generale.
And this credit is being extended for all kinds of things, for people to buy cars, for people to, you know, expand their business, whether it's small or relatively large. Like, this is kind of across India's economy.
Right.
So one of the companies, IL&FS, was taken over by the government this last October, 2018. And it sounds like the kind of story that we've seen out of China, that there was some mismanagement, some fraud, some people running away with the money. And unlike a bank, just less regulated and less of the financial controls to make sure that doesn't happen. So anywhere in the world where there's not enough people watching the till, there's going to be some running off with the money. So.
And it just never ceases to surprise me how credit is one of those things where having too much and having too little are both very bad. And it's just really hard to be in the Goldilocks position.
Yeah.
All right, now it's time for our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the fascinating story behind it, and especially the way that you tell it, Steve.
Indeed, yeah. I have actually kind of a happy number for my my hedge fund bros on the East Coast. So over the past two quarters, I think, this has been the best performing market for hedge funds in a very long time.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, look at that. Putting the fin back in fintech. So according to Bloomberg, hedge funds rose 5.7% from January through June, according to the Hedge Fund Research Incorporated, which is the highest gains they have seen since 2010.
I know that it said that it's like an asset-weighted index of managers. So could you kind of compare this 5.7% to, say, what the S&P 500 has done?
That is a great question. I know that from my personal investments, like my 401k and stuff, it's definitely been higher than 5.7%. But I know that about a year and a half ago, there was some talk.
Is that a humble brag?
Yeah. I no longer have perfect credit. It's like 847 now. I know that about a year and a half ago or so, there was some talk about how hedge funds had actually performed worse than the market. So maybe this is just compared to their horrendous quarters they had from 2010 through 2019 or so.
Yeah. So do we think any, like the guy who made the bet with Warren Buffett on the 10-year, like, I'll do my hedge fund and you do your S&P 500, do we think any of them are feeling ballsy enough for that again?
Is this the guy from Pershing Square? What's his name?
I can't remember his name.
It's a Wall Street douchebag from Connecticut. I know exactly who you mean.
I've
met those people. Right?
Steve's words, not mine.
Oh. Or then the Warren Buffett side one, right?
Warren won. Yeah. The S&P 500 won.
And then they did it again or something, right?
Warren Buffett's low-cost index fund.
Right.
Targeted to the S&P 500 won.
Did a lot better than a 2-in-20 structure hedge fund or PE fund. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, that's a number. Go hedge funders.
Hedging is back.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right.
Market domination.
Well, I'm up next with some news that came out today and was reported by the New York Times that French government has proposed enacting a 3% tax on the revenue that some companies earn from providing digital services to French users. And this particular tax policy, if it's enacted, would absolutely target companies like Amazon, Apple, I guess all your FANG types, Facebook, Google.
Baidu, all of them.
Yeah, although Baidu isn't mentioned in the article, that certainly doesn't mean... I wonder how much revenue is generated for Baidu by French users.
Very little.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So anyway, France had been trying to get the rest of its EU partners to go along with this, but it just kind of didn't work out. So France has decided to move on ahead. And this would be, you know, it would generate some money, something around 500 million euros, just about $563 million on an annual basis. I mean, that's not going to break the bank for those companies. However, the U.S. is not okay with this, and the U.S. government has kind of said that they're going to investigate it and see if it might violate
WTO.
Yeah, WTO rules, and if enacted, would the U.S. retaliate with tariffs?
Did
so,
France say, "Hey, you're not into these international agreements anyway"?
The article did not say. What I find very interesting here is just how you can have so much differentiation between different countries, the way they're going to tax and tolerate some of the biggest companies in the world. And it could actually lead to a lot of complexity for both governments who have to manage these taxes. Like, how exactly will France determine how much revenue was generated by French users of these certain companies, you know?
Right, yeah.
So
yeah. The advertising that goes to them.
Well, it's beyond that. It's, you know, how do you monetize your data? It's a little more
advertising.
Complicated than that. No, it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah? How? What other revenue do they get from someone going on the internet?
You can think about the way in which you can use user data to train an AI model, for example.
To like advertise better?
No, but I mean, that's not directly tied to like displaying an ad.
Right, but the data has value.
The data has value, exactly. So how do you
quantify revenue generating value that may not be captured in France.
Right. And which is not based purely on like ad impressions, right? So
yeah. So interesting stuff. And well, I guess tariffs are the new free trade agreement.
So I kind of lost track of this, but I know that maybe about 3 years ago or so there was a big initiative in France to raise taxes on the ultra wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument against yeah. And the argument against this was that people were going to leave France. And there's mm-hmm. a famous French actor who went to Russia.
Gerard Depardieu.
That big fella. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them. Johnny Halliday left.
He also left. So was that the actual outcome of this? Is that people ended up leaving France and going somewhere else? Or will this have a similar effect with these tech companies? That maybe they'll just withdraw from the French market? Or
I think they know, where are you going to go? Germany?
Yeah, and also it's a 3% tax. Like, you can still get to keep 97% of whatever the calculation is. That's not bad.
All right, on that happy note, I'm going to go to something that's pretty obvious. Like, how much do you have to put down to buy a house in San Francisco?
Oh, God. Typically, you go, say, 25% above asking, and you have to, if it's usually about $1 million, so $275,000.
Oh, for a studio, you mean?
For a studio, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right. No, zero.
What?
Zero is the amount you have to put down, according to a new company that's operating based out of San Francisco called ZeroDown.com. Actually, they have ads all around the city. I was surprised to see these guys
on like bus stops. Yeah, and at every bus stop, there's some freaking zero down payment.
Because that's really where I go to find my next financial provider for the biggest transaction of my life.
It used to be Brex.
Who advertises
Brex
on a bus?
Brex is still there. Now it's Gemini, the Winklevoss crypto exchange.
Yep.
There's a lot of buses here in San Francisco with the Gemini advertising. And just a side note, you know, I was in L.A. A few weeks ago, and all of the advertising is for a completely different industry. Everything's about a TV show or movies, and they all, I guess it's the season right now, they all have four-year consideration on the billboard or the bus.
It's award season.
It's award season.
Pre-award season stuff.
Yeah, it's like way early for award season.
So you know where the money around L.A. is coming from, you know, the Hollywood, the movie industry.
Mm-hmm.
But not so in San Francisco. Not a lot of filming going on in San Francisco, I guess. Some. But, yeah, our industry is definitely the tech, fintech, actually, too, industries. And, yeah, we can see this with us. And Zero.com is one of the new ones that I've noticed.
Zero Down.
Spelled out the letters, the words, ZeroDown.com, if you want to go check them out. And what you do is you apply. You still have to qualify, of course. But they look at more than just your credit score. They say they look at your whole financial situation.
Your Instagram followers.
So does the lender.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much their non-standard, kind of non-FHA credit factors play into it. But so once you qualify, you give them a $10,000 participation fee, or I'm sorry, they call it a program fee.
So a down payment.
So it's a fee. Yeah, right.
So it's not actually equity. It's money you'll never see again.
Right.
Yeah.
Great.
But for that $10,000, they buy a house for you that you pick, and they say that they'll close it in 7 days. They'll make it a cash offer, and they'll take care of your insurance and your property taxes, and you can move in, and you make just the one payment to ZeroDown.com, and they're the owners. And some part of your rent payment, it goes to a down payment. So not that different from a traditional rent-to-own kind of situation.
Wait, it goes to a down payment or it goes to your own equity? Because then you're going to have to buy it from them at some point in the future?
Yeah, they're going to sell it to you. So you have the option, actually. In between years 2 and 5, you can exercise your option to use your credits that you've accumulated to go ahead and buy the home.
And who sets the price?
I think it's for them to hedge the transaction so that there's no, you know, up and down volatility. I think it would almost have to be what they paid for it.
Oh, no way. No way. That is not going to be the deal.
Because then your credits would keep...
Because they've taken all the risk. And they've lost the time value of that money for 2 years or 5 years. No way.
Because then you'd never be able to afford the house because your credits would never...
Right.
Creep. And you know, the price would keep getting away from you.
Yeah.
So you're entering into a contract that this is going to happen based on your rent payments. So.
Buyer, beware.
So a way to get into a house with zero, in quotes, down.
I don't know. If you don't have enough for a down payment, maybe you don't want to buy a house. Maybe you want to rent for a while. Or
well, they're kind of saving the money for you kind of thing. So it's worked into the rent payments, but you end up buying a house through the process. So,
but do you and so you have to take title, like you have to purchase from zero before the 5 years are up?
No, if you don't buy the house, you get some of the money back, some of the credits that you've accumulated back.
Oh man, this sounds
so as
this
usual,
this deal. Yeah. Ain't going to work out for you.
Well, for you know, there's lots of different use cases. So for some people, this may be the way to go.
It may work, yeah.
It may work out.
Sure.
And, I mean, they're doing this for it to work, not for it not to work. Right. So check it out. Definitely do your research.
I would really like to see, like, a side-by-side with, like, okay, I'm just going to wait 5 years and save up my down payment money. or I'm going to throw 10,000 and have this. Like, what does it look like? What equity
well,
do you get?
Well, the problem with that, just like I tell people when they say I'm going to go to a junior college and then go up to a UC or a good college afterwards, there's too much life risk in that.
Yeah.
If you can go to the good college, the odds are that are much better that you're going to finish at that school than if you start with a junior college and you get sidetracked and never make that leap.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of for people that need that kind of incentive or that kind of like a plan or kind of laid out for them. This is like that guarantee that they're going to have the savings. They're already locked into making the rent payment.
Yeah, but
and they're not going to end up blowing their savings. And they're always having the five-year plan. And they never get to the house.
And what happens if the house doesn't rise in value, much less maintain it? What if there's a loss? I don't know.
Well, it's not for an investment. It's to buy a house to live in.
I know, but if you...
This isn't a speculative kind of contract.
No, I understand. But you have to, when you are actually buying it between years 2 and 5, are you buying it at the old price? You're paying more than it's actually worth. And at least when you are buying a house with a traditional down payment, you have some built-in protection from price drops because you've already got some equity. You know, the total amount of your mortgage is unlikely to equal the loss, although it certainly did happen in our lifetimes.
Yep.
I don't know. It just seems, just be real careful out there, people.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't go skydiving either, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You don't go skydiving, and some people do, and they're fine.
And some skydivers die.
And some skydivers die. And some people on the ground get hit by a bus, too.
Totally,
so.
Totally.
Or by a skydiver, yeah.
Or by a skydiver in one movie that I saw.
I would also love to know how much money ZeroDown is sitting on and where it came from.
It's all from Saudi Arabia. This is a Saudi Arabia backed company. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay,
no.
You don't know.
No,
all right.
No. But these are tech guys. One of the guys worked on Zenefits.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's, it kind of vaguely sounds related, right?
No, like it's not.
ZeroDown Zenefits?
Yeah.
No, Zenefits is kind of like automating this kind of complicated
payroll regulating.
And kind of doing it, making it just one payment for you kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of like the same thing. We'll do all the back end kind of work, and then you do this one payment, and you can transfer into a house kind of thing. All right, well, check it out. And yes, you still do need that $10,000 program fee for them to start the whole process going. All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.